Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Juliana versus the United States, a lawsuit brought by young plaintiffs between the ages of 11 and 23, asserts that the U.S. government, through its affirmative actions in creating a national energy system that causes climate change, is depriving them of their constitutional rights to life, liberty, and property, and has failed to protect essential public trust resources. The case is one of many related legal actions brought by youth in several states and countries, all supported by Our Children's Trust, and all seeking science-based action by governments to stabilize the climate system. This case has taken a torturous course through the courts, and tomorrow the next step takes place in Portland. Today we talk with Danny Noonan, a lawyer for Our Children's Trust, Vic Barrett, one of the plaintiffs, and Amanda Hendrickson, a Lewis and Clark student organizer, who will talk about the case and tomorrow's hearing and rally. Danny, Vic, and Amanda, welcome to Locus Focus.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow's a big day, but this has been a very long journey. So I wanted to start by talking about the beginning of this journey and what this case is about and why it's here in Oregon, for that matter.
Yeah, I'll take that one. Thank
you. This is Danny, who's a lawyer.
Yeah, I'm part of the legal team supporting the Juliana v. United States lawsuit. So the lawsuit was filed in August 2015, and Barbara, you gave a fantastic summary of the basis for the lawsuit.
Actually, I just took it from the press release. I've never read so much legal jargon in my life. Nor have I been surrounded by so many Australians.
Well, you nailed it, so thank you. It was filed in 2015. We filed in the District Court of Oregon. About half the plaintiffs are from either Oregon or the Western U.S., and then the other half of the plaintiffs are from all over the country, you know, Hawaii, Alaska, Florida, New York. And, you know, it's been a long journey. You know, we filed this case in 2015. The first major decision was in 2016, where Judge Ann Aiken in the U.S. District Court for the District of Oregon issued a ruling that denied the government's motion to dismiss the case. And since then, we've been up to the Ninth Circuit five times. This is the fifth time that we've had to fight back a government motion or petition to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the Court of Appeals that covers the whole sort of western, you know, west coast of the U.S. And we've been to the Supreme Court twice, and twice the Supreme Court's knocked the government back. So it's been a pretty incredible journey up to this point. And, you know, perhaps Vic would like to talk about how you became involved, because that's a really interesting story in itself.
Yeah, actually, it's interesting that a lot of the plaintiffs are on the West Coast, but Vic, you're from New York.
Yes.
And what is your story, and how did you get involved with this lawsuit?
Yeah, well, I got involved with climate activism in general in my freshman year of high school when I was 13 years old.
And where do you live, by the way?
I grew up in the Hudson Valley, New York, and then moved to Westchester, New York, and I went to school in the West Village of Manhattan. Yeah, so I just got engaged with nonprofit organizations in New York City that were working on teaching kids about global citizenship and teaching young people about climate change and the way that it's impacting us. And I remember at first when I joined, for example, this nonprofit, Global Kids, and went to the Human Rights Activist Project, they were talking about climate change, and I was like, oh, what does this have to do with human rights? And I grew up in a very conservative town upstate, and I was like, it was just me breaching all these issues for the first time. And I just remember learning about the ways that in New York City, people of color and low-income people were disproportionately impacted by Hurricane Sandy because public housing is more likely to be built in areas susceptible to flooding. And this was also happening during the time where Black Lives Matter was really taking off and there was a lot of violence happening against the Black community. And just learning that not only is it, you know, a police officer who can put your life at risk, but literally, like, the people who are supposed to protect you are putting your housing in places that's more likely to kill you at the end of the day. And coming to those realizations was really integral in me getting involved in the movement at all, and just kind of thrusted me into doing all the work that I could in New York City. And I was working with the Alliance for Climate Education, who's partnered with Our Children's Trust on curriculum and on lawsuits in the past. And yeah, they connected me to the organization, and we just started having conversations about this concept of taking legal action. And being a young activist in New York, I was realizing, like, yeah, me and my friends are talking to all these city council members and people who should be listening to us, but they're not really. You know, they're letting us into their offices so we can tell them, like, our talking points and then taking photo ops and then never really wanting to talk to us again because we weren't going to be voting for them the next year. And so this opportunity to look at the actual facts and look at how we want our government to be accountable to us, and having to put it right in front of them and them having to answer to it, just sounded like exactly what I needed in the moment to be still energized to do the work as a youth activist. And that's how I got involved.
So Danny, let's talk a bit about the Our Children's Trust and how did that organization get started?
It was founded back in 2010 by Julia Olson, who is our executive director, was an environmental lawyer. And the sort of story goes that Julia had been watching, while pregnant, I think, with her first or second child, I can't quite remember, had been watching An Inconvenient Truth, which, you know, seems to be a gateway to activism for...
A gateway drug to activism.
She was an environmental litigator already and had been fighting various battles throughout the West in courts, and decided that she wanted to do something about climate change. And, you know, the original idea she had was sort of a conventional idea for environmental litigation. I'll just bring a sort of administrative challenge. I'll try and stop a particular development. And she said it was like playing whack-a-mole, you know. And that's kind of been the story of environmental litigation over the last couple of decades, you know, in the US and in other places, is, you know, a coal mine pops up, you knock it back, it pops up again. Or Jordan Cove, for example, you know, that pipeline just, you know, it has 9 lives at least. And so she realized that, you know, it wasn't these individual developments that are causing climate change. It's the fossil fuel energy system. It's the aggregate acts of our government in creating that fossil fuel energy system that are causing the problem. And so that's one part of the founding story. The other part is that Julie was teaching at the University of Oregon at the time, sort of in an adjunct role, and got connected with Professor Mary Wood, who's an academic there, who was talking about using the public trust doctrine and applying that, you know, ancient legal doctrine to the atmosphere as a natural resource. And so they sort of got connected, and Julia realized that she could use these theories and then sort of built on that to build the sort of constitutional theories that are at the heart of the Giuliani case, in order to bring a wave of lawsuits against governments at the state level, at the federal level, and internationally. And using those sort of fundamental legal concepts to really get at the heart of the issue.
So this particular case, Giuliani versus the United States, is only one of several different cases going on?
Yeah, so currently we have active cases that we are supporting in Alaska, Washington, Oregon, about to go up to the Supreme Court in Oregon. We just got granted that appeal, and Florida. And we're supporting cases globally in India, Pakistan, and Uganda, and hoping to support some more in the near future.
Well, Danny, Vic, I have this question for you, and then I want to ask it for Amanda, because I think you guys are pretty close in age. Actually, I was emailed by one of the people who organized this discussion today that I had to raise the ages of the plaintiffs from 11 to 22, which was in the press release, to 11 to 23. So I'm not sure if you're the one who turned 23.
No, I'm 20.
So anyway, and one of the scary things is to think, well, how many of these plaintiffs are no longer going to be youth by the time this is settled?
But that's a comment we get a lot.
So I wanted to ask you, Vic, first, and then Amanda, why the youth aspect? Why do you think it's so compelling that we look at the threat of climate change and the legal ramifications of it through the lens of youth plaintiffs?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question that even goes like past the legal aspect also. But looking at just the facts that young people are going to be handed a world that's not like a world that generations have been handed before because of climate change. And not only that, but we're like in this crunch time. It's not like, it's no longer us just talking about like, well, what are we going to do for our kids? It's like, we have 12 years to stop irreversible climate change. We have, Levi's 11. Our youngest plaintiff is 11. In 12 years, he's going to be 23. You know, that's not a lot of life to live before you're also dealing with an earth that's literally crumbling because of something that generations in the past have done. And I think it's important when we're looking at the law specifically to look at the fact that young people are being disproportionately impacted by climate change. Young people by themselves are a frontline community, really. And in the same way that I was talking about people of color being disproportionately impacted by climate change, young people are another group that are being impacted in a way, and that we have like less political agency in a lot of ways, like examples I was giving before, to address it. And we're disenfranchised in politics in order to address it. And that's why it's important that young people have the mic and are taking to the streets or are being in the courts to talk about these issues.
Now, how long, Amanda, have you been involved in this? And I also want to get your perspective. So how old are you, Amanda?
I'm 19, almost 20.
Oh, so you're more younger than Vic. Okay.
Sometime this month, I'll be 20.
Yeah, I just turned 20.
So. So how did you get involved, Amanda?
Yeah, so I actually just recently got involved about 2 months ago, which is super recent, but I've done a lot in the last 2 months. So I first met Dylan Plummer, who is the public engagement organizer for our Children's Trust. Him and Corey, which is the community engagement manager, they came to the law school, Lewis and Clark Law School. I'm not at the law school. I'm at the undergraduate school. But they were doing a presentation there about our Children's Trust. And my friend and I had attended because we'd been going to all these presentations. And I just kind of had this like epiphany moment where I was sitting there and I was like, holy cow, like, our government should be protecting our climate and our planet. Like, why is this? Why are we acting like they like it's not one of our rights as an American? And so I just like had this epiphany moment where I was just like, okay, Madeline, my friend that was there, I was like, we need to get involved in this. Like, more people need to be thinking about it in that way, that the United States is supposed to be protecting your rights to life, liberty, and they're not. And so I think what's really important, like with what Vic was saying about the youth aspect, is I've been going around to schools like Portland State University and PCC, and it's just crazy seeing the different responses from different age groups. And I feel like definitely the younger generations are just so much more excited to get on board with this. And like the most common response I've been getting from older generations is, well, good luck with that. And it's been like almost a joke between like all the people that are in my group that have been organizing this, is like, older generations don't see this case as involving everyone, and they see the 21 plaintiffs as like their own individuals, but they don't understand that the 21 plaintiffs are representing all of us in this case.
Including their grandchildren.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking about Juliana versus the United States lawsuit with Danny Noonan, a lawyer for Our Children's Trust, Vic Barrett, one of the plaintiffs, and Amanda Hendrickson, a Lewis and Clark student organizer. I was thinking as you were talking, Vic, about the way that young people are kind of disenfranchised. And it seems to me that the climate struggle is analogous in a lot of ways to the anti-violence gun control struggle that really blew up as a youth issue mm-hmm. after the tragedy in Florida last year. And I wonder if you see a comparison and if there's any kinds of alliances between the young people who are fighting against gun violence and the young people who are fighting against climate violence.
Yeah, I think I definitely see the parallels for sure. I think it still deals with youth activism in a lot of ways is looking at the fundamental like basis of the fact that we're going to inherit the world that we're growing up in right now. And if that world doesn't reflect what we want or what we need, then what is it going to look like when we have to be leading it? And I think that's what we see when we talk about gun control, what we see when we talk about climate change. And it's like, if young people have a different idea of how guns should be controlled in this country because of the lived experience of like being a young person and knowing that however many young people a year die in school, like being shot in school, in the same way that we know that climate change is going to disproportionately impact a lot of young people in the way that we're going to be growing up into a world that's literally different, fundamentally different than the world that we were raised in and that our parents were raised in. And I think there could definitely be more intersections between these youth activist groups fighting for these different things, talking about it, like getting together. But I think that I think also that everyone is so focused in the momentum that youth activism is getting right now that we're each in our own little like groups trying to be like, all right, well, this is what we need to focus on because we have the attention now, we have the light now, and so we need to be doing that. But I think there's definitely room for more intersectional work with that because it's all these issues are connected in a lot of ways too. So.
Well, there's a real power of youth. As I'm talking, I'm remembering when I was a youth and actually I was fighting against the Vietnam War. And when I was 19, I was part of taking over the president's office at Columbia University to try to stop the war and the university's implications with the war and with racism. And in those days, a lot of older people looked at us and were going, oh, you're just young people. What do you know? And what's your program? And all you mm-hmm. want to do is destroy. You don't want to build. My sense about the youth movement now is, for one thing, I would hardly say that it's about wanting to destroy rather than wanting to construct. The people who I see wanting to destroy are like the current presidential administration. So I wonder what you can teach us. And also back to what Amanda was saying, that people who are my age go, well, good luck, as if not seeing that the perpetuation of a healthy planet is not just something we care about until we die. I mean, I have friends my age who are going, well, I won't be around, I'm so glad I won't be around. But I don't see it that way. And I see it like I'm just as invested as a young person because I don't want to die thinking that the Earth's going to die with me. So how do we, what is the difference? I guess, I'm not sure how much you know about the youth movement of 40 years ago, but I'm curious if you have a sense of maybe you've learned from history and understood how a youth movement can move forward in a way that can really bring constructive change as opposed to just looking like a destructive force.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that there's a lot of positive energy into what people are talking about, and climate change is one of those issues that's so solutions-based, and these solutions exist, so it's like, I think it's easier for us to have things to say like, well, these are the things that we need to do, almost to the point where it's ridiculous. You know, we have all these facts, we have all these things that we know we can do to change the issue. And it's just looking at the bigger systemic reasons that we need to be considering as to why it's so hard for us to do this work when it seems so rational and so like it shouldn't be that hard. You know what I mean?
Well, there's like so much frustration. We think we all feel about like, why don't you get it?
Mm-hmm.
I want to go back to our lawyer here, Danny. How does the legal system maybe help us to get this question of why can't we do something, to turn it around to something of what can we do and who's really accountable?
Yeah, well, I think you have to go back, I mean, particularly in the US legal system, and sort of look at the history of civil rights as they've been litigated through the courts. And so, you know, this case has been very consciously modeled around that. And so one of the things we're looking for in the case is the court to declare the fundamental rights of these plaintiffs, and that includes a fundamental right to a climate system capable of sustaining human life. And then that right would then become the tool for future legal battles, but it would also mandate, in effect, that the government come up with a plan. We've been calling it a climate recovery plan, but, you know, a plan to transition the US off of fossil fuels. And the government would be able to come up with whatever, you know, the details of that plan. And really, it would be up to the public and the broader movement to push them on what that plan is and to keep the pressure up. And, you know, we saw that in Brown v. Board of Education and, you know, even the same-sex marriage cases. There was a sort of, at the same time that the lawyers were fighting in courts, there was this movement building underneath, and they kind of worked with each other to bring about social change.
Well, the thing that freaks me out is we have this is 12-year thing, which is shrieking down. Now it's only 11 and a half years. that we don't have a lot of time left. I mean, with... as a lesbian, I mean, I was struggling for equality for, you know, like a long time, 40 years. And the difference is, I mean, it affected my life. It really affected it positively when lesbian and gay people started getting more rights. But it wasn't going to be the end of the planet if we didn't. And the same thing with civil rights. It was pretty horrible what African Americans were going through, but it wasn't like, I mean, 5 years wasn't going to change the ability of a future to exist. So with this very narrow time frame, how do we survive? I mean, how do we get the justice system, which moves very, very slowly, to speed up and to recognize the fact that we don't have much time left?
Well, I think that, you know, I don't have a concrete answer for that. And you're right that this is the sort of the first sort of civil rights action or movement that has a pretty clear, you know, deadline that it needs to meet. This isn't a right that we can secure, you know, 20 years down the road. We have to secure it in the next couple years, or, you know, it will lose to some extent its meaning. And I think that just means we need to work harder. You know, not to suggest that previous movements haven't worked hard. Of course they have, but, you know, this is kind of an end game. It's a critical fight, and, you know, everyone needs to get off the sidelines, and that includes people who normally sit back and, you know, play more of a commentary role. They have to do both. They can commentate, but they need to be in the streets as well.
Well, I'm thinking about some of these people who are running for president right now on the Democratic option. And one particular is the governor of the state just north of us, Jay Inslee, who was running, and he announced as a climate hero, basically. He was putting climate justice, basically, into the campaign and put it into the public conversation. I appreciated that a lot, except that at the same time, he wasn't coming out against these two big frack gas projects in Washington. And it took until a month ago for him to finally make a positive statement. What lessons can we learn about what it took for Jay Inslee to come around and to also look at the disconnect between what politicians say and what they're actually doing, and how to make them start to do what they say?
I think Vic's better to speak on that, but I will just say before that, we've sued Governor Inslee and his administration probably, I think, three times at this point, or at least twice. And, You know, we've had a few wins in the Washington state courts, and we've even had, you know, meetings with the plaintiffs and Governor Inslee, and we've been really disappointed with him as a you know, he talks a big game on climate, but actually seeing the concrete actions, like you mentioned, you know, it's been too little too late, and there's always an excuse. And
do you think he's doing any better now that he's come out so strongly against Tacoma LNG and Kalama methanol?
I think particularly since he's decided to step up to the national stage, you know, he's been facing a bit more criticism, particularly from, you know, from the youth and from some of the local organizations, and he's needed to respond to that to maintain credibility. But in terms of how he push up politicians, I think Vic's much better at talking about that.
Well, before we get to Vic, what about Kate Brown? Have you sued her yet?
Kate Brown is also a defendant in one of our lawsuits. Similar story, you know. We've pushed Governor Brown quite a few times and have not had the kind of response we need. And, I mean, that really gets back to the fact that, and as someone who's originally from Australia, I've experienced this myself, you know, we've had quite a few elections now fought almost centrally around climate change. And
the last one was pretty bleak.
Yeah, it was pretty bleak. And I feel like the takeaway from that is, you know, the sort of political triangulations, you know, picking the least bad political party on climate change policy is a losing strategy. And if it isn't supported by a grassroots movement and a movement encouraging the other branches of government, in particular the courts, to actually set some hard limits on what governments can and can't do, then, you know, we're going to struggle, because at the end of the day, governments like to be seen to be doing things on climate change, but they don't actually like to take action on climate change.
Well, it's really hard, but Vic, let's get your take on this. And what do we do with politicians?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, going into the election, we see not even just talking about climate change, but in general, the way young people are responding and interacting with politics nowadays is much, and to some people, chagrin, it's like almost controversial in a way, but are much less forgiving of like what you mess up on, you know what I mean? People are much less willing to be like, oh, well, but, you know, I guess you're doing the best you can. Because young people have this sense of urgency now where it's like, no, we need you to be doing actually the best that you can, and not like the political best that you can, but actually be a civil servant and represent us in the way that you're meant to, and not just for the like red carpet walk of running for the election. And I think that we've seen that on the international stage too. Like, me and Danny were in at COP24 in Poland, and a lot of what U.S. organizers were talking about on the ground was these like U.S. governors, like, I don't remember if Kate Brown went to COP24, but like Jerry Brown and Kate Brown and a lot of these governors from the United States and mayors who will be like, oh, you know, we're very green, so we're going to go to COP24 and talk about how green we are in the United States, when really a lot of them, like, we're talking about have, you know, fossil fuel infrastructure projects going in their backyard. This is concept of greenwashing and of trying to appeal to the broader climate movement as it's getting more popular, but really it's empty. And I think that a lot of young people, a lot of youth activists are really addressing that and putting a lot of pressure that we see. Because now, I mean, in the 2016 election, I would have loved if climate change was as central as it's been in this election. And I think that it's because of the youth movement and how we've been standing up and saying, like, we're not just going to let you, like, not talk about this issue and pretend that it doesn't exist or pretend that you're doing something about it when you're not. We actually need tangible, like, clear action from you, and we're going to ask for it.
Well, I'm going to tell you a little local story that happened here in Portland. We had this mayor. His name was Charlie Hales, mm-hmm. and he was really tied in. He was a liberal Democrat, but he was also very tied in with the developers and real estate, and it turns out with the fossil fuel industry. And he also saw himself as a green mayor, and he touted, liked to go around the country touting all of Portland's great green achievements, of which there have been some for sure. In the meantime, he was working with the Port of Portland to bring in Pembina, which we now know more famously with connected with Jordan Cove, but they wanted to build a very large liquid propane by rail terminal in Portland at Hayden Island. And this kind of snuck by, and nobody really knew it was going to happen. And then it came out, and people started protesting. Meanwhile, Charlie Hales went to meet with the Pope, with a bunch of other mayors, and he was touting again how Portland was this great green city. And while he was in the Vatican, the movement grew, and it was like so clear that Portland did not want this liquid propane terminal. When he came back from meeting with the Pope, he did a 180 turnaround, pulled the proposal, and just discarded it, and then proposed this ban on fossil free infrastructure in Portland forever, mm-hmm. and became a great champion of climate protection. some of that I'm a little cynical about, but that was kind of the trajectory of a politician. And it seemed that the lesson from that was grassroots organizing, and maybe you have to go see the Pope.
Yeah. Sure. No, I was about to say, it's interesting that, you know, that response could be garnered from going seeing the Pope in maybe Italy or Europe, when there's definitely front lines activists right here in his own city who are asking him to do the same exact thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what being a politician is sometimes, I guess. Though.
So I'm curious, with your take here, that you've been a student, Amanda, at Lewis and Clark now for, what, 2 years, sophomore?
Yeah, just finished sophomore year.
And I'm wondering, how aware were you when you came to Lewis and Clark about climate issues, and how much has changed in the time that you've been in college?
Yeah, so going into Lewis and Clark, I kind of knew I wanted to do sociology and anthropology. And I kind of was just like, okay, like, this will be my field. And then all those environmental science people, that'll be their thing. And, like, of course I was interested in, like, environmental science and, like, learning about all this stuff. But I was just like, oh, like, leave it up to those people. And I feel like that's kind of the general public's kind of view on this, is like, oh, there's people working on this, like, we can leave it to them, they're the experts. And it's really daunting, especially as a youth, because I feel like youth get told this all the time, is like, oh, like, you don't know all the facts, like, you don't know all the specifics. And that's true. Like, I feel like it's a daunting thing to be on the radio right now, like, talking about things where I'm not super sure on the history, I don't know the exact dates and stuff. But And I'm sure, like, so many other people feel this, and that's what prevents them from speaking out and joining movements, is because they feel like, their voice is not as powerful as someone else's. And so, like, when I went to the Our Children's Trust meeting, and I, like, had that epiphany moment, like, learning about these youth, even just 11 years old, speaking up about this, there's, like, so many people that say, oh, these are just children, they don't know what they're talking about. But they do know what they're talking about. It's directly affecting them. And maybe they don't know all the science behind it specifically, but it's affecting them directly, and that's all that matters. And there's so many people out there that are being affected but are scared to speak up because they're kind of being told by our society that you need to be an expert if you want to speak up. Yeah.
I think the children are the experts now. But I want to let listeners know that you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking about the Juliana versus United States lawsuit with Danny Newman, who's a lawyer for Our Children's Trust, the kind of umbrella organization that's bringing a number of these lawsuits against different countries, governments, including the United States. Vic Barrett, who's one of the plaintiffs, who's from New York State, and Amanda Hendrickson, who's a Lewis and Clark student organizer here in Portland. There's this kind of moment when, as a young person, you realize that you maybe know more than people want to give you credit for. And I'm remembering, again, when I was a student activist, and that there was, I started reading a lot, and there seemed to be this opportunity that opened up when I got to college that wasn't there for me before. However, I'm thinking about my sister, who's 3 years younger than me, and the anti-Vietnam War movement was like full force when she was in high school, so she had a very different high school experience than I had. I think we're more in that time, that it seems like in the last 10 years, young people have become much more engaged. And I'm wondering, what was your experience, Vic, in terms of how young were you when you started to really get what was going on?
Yeah, in my freshman year of high school, when I was 13 years old, is when I started getting involved. But what you're saying is totally true, in seeing, like, the way that the energy shifts. Because when I was 13 and getting involved in 2013, it was definitely like we were trying to figure out, so what do we want to do? Like, it was me and my friends, like, what campaign are we going to work on? And we were talking about and realizing, oh, we need other young people to be working on this with us. Oh, how much do other young people actually know about climate change? So the first campaign I worked on was actually trying to mandate climate education in New York City public schools, because we realized that, like, people don't know what's actually going on. And I think it's been interesting to see how in the last, I don't know, just watching the climate movement and the way that exists now, it's like, that's definitely when I was a freshman, a sophomore, a junior in high school, that's what we were really wanting. Like, that's what we wanted the climate movement to look like. And now that it does look like that, it's insane seeing the amount of, like, because it's all what we were always saying, but, like, people didn't want to believe, is like, oh, we just need the energy. We just need more young people. And a lot of people were like, well, what's that going to do? But it's the pressure that, like, really helps and puts things on. Yeah.
Well, I've been recording a lot of hearings about these the whack-a-moles that we've been whacking down oil by rail terminal in Vancouver and Jordan Cove and Calama Methanol and Tacoma LNG. And one of the things that really strikes me, because I've been going through these recordings I've made in the last few weeks and listening to all these young people who testify, and I will say that some of them know a lot more than some of the adults that come out, particularly when they're looking at the environmental impact statement and the draft supplemental environmental impact statements and all these things. And some of these young people that are testifying understand what like global warming potential means, what methane leakage rates are. And this is one young woman in particular who lives in Calama. And I was listening to some of her footage last night, and she started out being 14, and the last thing I recorded, she's now identifying herself as 17. And so she's been growing up with this. But I think that there are young people out there who know every bit as much or more than a lot of the adults, particularly the politicians that they're confronting. I'm wondering if you're having that. Well, actually, I'll throw that out to you, Danny. I mean, are you finding that young people are just as well informed in a lot of ways?
Oh, absolutely. So when I first became involved with this lawsuit back in 2015, I was an intern at Our Children's Trust, and one of my now co-workers, Nate, we were about to meet several of the plaintiffs who are now known as the Juliana plaintiffs for the first time. And it was my first interaction with these young kids. And right before they turned up, Nate said something along the lines of, you know, the best part of this job, and I just had my head in legal cases for the last 2 weeks, he said, the best part of this job is meeting and working with these kids. And at the time, I was like, oh, yeah, sure, okay. I was in my mid-20s myself, you know.
These
I was
kids.
Like, yeah. It's like I'm kind of happy not to be interacting with kids for a while. That's absolutely the case. They're amazing. Each of them has takes an approach to this issue in a different way, and they're all more informed, way more informed than I was at their age, their comparative age, and just really articulate. And I feel like that's starting to be recognized, you know, more broadly. I mean, there's always going to be these kind of, for lack of a better word, sort of bad faith critiques that, you know, all these kids don't know what they're talking about, which is really just a way of trying to sort of control and silence their voice. But, you know, our politicians just invited one of Vic's co-plaintiffs, Argy, to speak before a House Select Committee on the Climate Crisis. So the politicians are also recognizing that these kids do have something important to say.
And it's also indicative. That's like so indicative of the stake that we have in the issue. Like, I feel like the amount of that people are going out of, like young people are going out of their way to educate themselves is just further proof that it's because we feel the sense of urgency about what's happening.
Well, that's another thing I get, whether I'm listening to people, young people I don't know very well or don't know at all who are testifying, or talking to actually particularly a very close friend who's 24. And my partner and I were talking to her a couple of years ago and climate change came up, and we were cheerfully talking about all these wonderful things. And all of a sudden she broke into tears. And she was like, it was so hard for her to talk about it. And I don't think climate activism is her focus. I mean, she's very politically engaged, but she's very aware of it. And in a way, because I'm so close to her, I realized that's when I started feeling what it feels like to be a young person and to be faced with no future, even though I've been hearing people saying this to me for a while. But of course, it's all this, the more personal it is, the more you get it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I wonder if you can communicate that to the listeners, particularly everybody who's like over 50 who's listening right now, about what it feels like when you look ahead 12 years and you wonder if the world's going to be recognizable.
Yeah.
I think sometimes for me that's hard to put into words because I don't know what it looks like to not feel that way also. Just because, like you're saying, it's like growing up in this reality. And I think it's so, like one of the experts on our case deals with development and deals with like the impact that this particularly has on young people in our social, our emotional development. Part of being a member of the lawsuit, one of the experts we talked to was a psychiatrist, one of the two.
Yeah, Dr. Lisa Van Susteren is an expert on the psychological impacts on young people because of climate change.
Yeah, and just as important part in my complaint as a plaintiff about like the physical things that climate change does, just an important part of my complaint personally is like the psychological harm of knowing that the world is not going to be the same for me. It's a really complex, like daunting feeling to have as a young person, and even to unpack as a young person, because there's so many other things we're learning about our feelings, you know, and trying to figure out about how we exist. And also you have to be unpacking like, oh, but this like doomsday scenario that like plays in your head. And yeah, it's definitely hard to put into words, but just as like daunting as you would think that feels, and like as much weight as you would think it takes, it really does. And I think that young people are just like skilled at being able to like exist with that and interact with that and like laugh and play Uno in, you know, our like our hotel rooms, knowing that like, oh, we're all here because we're suing the U.S. federal government. Oh, because climate disaster is a huge issue. Oh, because the Earth has like 12 more years to figure things out.
Well, when I was working on my first project a number of years ago about climate change, and I was talking with an ecologist who taught me the word stationarity, which I never heard of, and it means basically that you would expect, it's a term that we'd use for developing infrastructure, building dams, building power stations, whatever, that you assume that things will be the same in the future as they are in the now, in the present, and that some of the, she showed me this article that some engineer had written about the end of stationarity, and this was, I think, like 2010. Mm-hmm. And it was a really hard thing to wrap my brain around. And that when I, it's weird, it was such a strange abstract word that felt so unemotional and kind of, you know, dry. And yet it was the word that shook me up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that, Amanda, is like something that you think about. I mean,
oh,
is this
yeah.
what, and how, and, but the difference being, I was like 60 when I learned yeah. the word. And how does it feel to grow up with understanding that things are not going to be soon in the future the way that you expect them to be?
Yeah, like with my interactions with people as I'm like going to different colleges and talking to people about this case and like just seeing that difference in the generations and their responses, I think what's so different about youth is like, as Vic was saying, like we've grown up with this fear like our whole lives. Like I remember hearing back when I was like in first grade, like hearing like save the polar bears, like and seeing all these yeah. images of like icebergs melting, and you just like being told that from such a young age, it gets like ingrained in you, and just hearing it all the time. And it's the same with like gun violence and mm-hmm. hearing all of these things, it almost becomes like the way you think. And I remember I just the other day, there's like that shooting in, I can't remember.
Is it Virginia Beach?
Yeah, Virginia yeah. Beach. And I just remember seeing something online about that and thinking to myself, like, why am I not feeling something? Like, why is this not surprising to me?
Yeah.
And I think that's, it's part of growing up with this culture is mm-hmm. you just, it's like part of everyday life. And so now we're, and but now as we're hearing like all these numbers of how many years we have, it's, mm-hmm. I feel like it's different psychologically for us youth, because we've been hearing this our whole lives. And so we're like, okay, we need to really strap down because we only have 12 years. And there's this quote, I can't think of the author off the top of my head, but he says, it's easier to imagine an end to the world than an end to capitalism. And I think that that is so true.
Yeah.
And people are just in this mindset where we, business as usual, Barbara, we met at the Powell's bookstore. Bill McKibben was having a book reading there, and he said this quote that I wrote down, we need disruption of business as usual. Mm-hmm. And it's this whole mindset where we're not going to change a system if we work within the system. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we need to step outside the system. And I think that's where older generations are having a harder time accepting this movement, is because younger people are more willing to step outside the system. And like people like Greta Thunberg, who skipping school every Friday
yeah.
to make a stance. I've heard from so many people, oh, she just doesn't want to go to school. She wants to find a way out of this. And there's just so many ways that people are twisting what we're doing in this movement to make it selfish somehow, mm-hmm. when really this is all about saving everybody here, saving the earth, saving our resources. Yeah.
And it speaks to what you were saying before about, you know, like to us, this movement can't seem destructive. But I think to the people who see the who from the outside, who have like bad things to say about it, it seems like we're trying to like take apart
exactly.
their way of life. For the narrative, like when people are questioning us, it's like, oh, so you don't take planes and you don't want us to drive cars. And like the
yes.
United States was built off the fossil fuel industry, and the Industrial Revolution is what got us here. Like, thank God you have lights. It's all these red herring arguments to make us feel like, oh, we're taking apart the way things work. But it's like, of course we are. Like, biodiversity is
yeah,
like
look
dying
at where it got us.
Yeah, like, exactly. Because we have to. Yeah.
Well, actually, when you mentioned, Amanda, about old people not getting this, well, I'm just thinking there's a move, you know, you've heard about the Extinction Rebellion movement
yeah.
was started in London. Yes. And, you know, it's spread to Portland. Mm-hmm. And there have been two arrests on the railroad tracks by Zenith Energy in the Portland port to stop them from shipping oil, tar sands oil through mm-hmm. Portland. And I was looking at the ages of the first group that got arrested. And there was one person who was 19, and mm-hmm. the next leap up was in the 50s. And mm-hmm. then there were a few people in their 60s and a bunch in their 70s and somebody in their 80s. So interestingly, I think some people who or at least of the age group, yeah. that they might be invested in the way things are not of the mindset.
Yeah.
And how do you connect with these folks?
I feel like I've noticed that a lot of our supporters for the lawsuit, you know, a lot of the people who come to every hearing are like, are they called the Raging Grannies?
Yes. Raging Grannies.
Yeah. Yeah. And even in I go to school in Madison, Wisconsin, when we have youth climate events, like a lot of the people you'll see there, and Madison, as you probably know, is like a huge hub for like anti-Vietnam War protests. And a lot of those same people are still there. And, you know, they're coming into the fight against climate change is what I see really often. And I think it's really awesome to see that intergenerational interaction and see the amount of grace and like space and recognition that those people have of like, oh, you know, I relate to you in a lot of ways because I was like an activist when I was younger, but also this like realization that what the way that, you know, their generations before them existed and the things that they were unconscious of but have affected us, it's like it's a lot of what drives them to do the work and to be so supportive of young people. And it's really amazing to see.
I was just going to say it was interesting that Amanda brought up Milbert Kibben, because one of the things he's always talked about when it comes to civil disobedience is, you know, that really should be a burden that's bared by older generations, you know, and not necessarily by younger people or frontline communities.
He said that day in his reading too.
Yeah,
it's in his book. And yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I mean, you know, when you're a young person, you know, getting arrested can have a lot of consequences for you. And I think he says, you know, when you're an older person, there's not much more they can do to you.
Well, actually, when I was getting arrested when I was young, which I only did a couple times, it didn't really have any consequences. And I think that now it's having a lot more, and particularly for young people of color.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
It could be a death sentence,
an
extrajudicial death sentence. So I think there's a lot more at stake. But also, I think that the issues are on a place that I can't even begin to conceive of just how dire climate change feels to somebody who's going to be projecting like what's going to be like to live in 2050.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's, to me, a place where it's a moment to sort of pause, and I think for my generation, a time for us to listen. So what do you want us to hear about this?
It's hard. I think in the context of the lawsuit, in the context of the youth climate movement in general, I think that what's really important is platforms and providing platforms for as many young people as possible. And not just, you know, like young people who have already been very involved and are like on lawsuits against the U.S. federal government, but like young people in your own community and providing those platforms for them. I think a big support that I've seen in Madison, particularly with a lot of the older community, is they're always asking us, like, what space can we create for you? Like, what resources do we have that we can give you for you to do the work? And not like for them to co-opt the work and like take lead of it, but for them to really like give us the resources and the platform and the space to like do the work that in the ways that they have access to. Like, I met this amazing, I can't remember his name right now, but this amazing guy in Madison that came to the youth climate strike, and he met me afterwards, and he was like, I'm thinking of setting, I think he was a minister at like a Unitarian church or something, and he's like, I really want to try to make like a room in the basement of the church where we like, where young people could come and gather and organize. And I was like, that's amazing. That's exactly what young people need right now. And it's like, it's just him providing the resources he has to help us out. And that's really important.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking about the youth climate movement and focused around the hearing tomorrow for the Juliana versus United States lawsuit that's happening in Portland at 1:30. And there's going to be a rally at Directors Park in support. And do any of you have the address for Directors Park off the top of your head?
Probably should.
Or our phones. I mean, okay, well, pull that out, Danny, while I continue talking.
I'm not from Portland, so I have an excuse.
but we're here with Danny Noonan, who's a lawyer for Our Children's Trust, Vic Barrett, who's one of the plaintiffs, who currently lives in Madison, Wisconsin, and Amanda Hendrickson, who's a student at Lewis and Clark College. And you have the address yet? Not yet.
Well, he turned his phone off.
I'll get it while we're talking. But let's talk about this rally tomorrow and also what is happening in the hearing, because we talked a little bit about the kind of torturous course of this lawsuit. But what is exactly, why are you going to court tomorrow?
Yeah, so we're going to court tomorrow for hearing on the government's, they brought what's called an interlocutory appeal of the decisions of the district court.
And what does that mean?
So an interlocutory appeal is an appeal before a final judgment by the trial court in the case. So what the district court has done up to this point is the government's brought motions to dismiss the case and a motion for what's called summary judgment, which is another way to dismiss the case before you have a trial. The district courts denied both of those, and the government succeeded in what is the exception to the normal rule, which is that you're supposed to have a trial. The government succeeded in circumventing that normal rule and bring in an interlocutory appeal.
So they brought the appeal before. Usually you do appeal after you've had a court decision.
Yeah, right? after you've had the trial.
And this is actually, is this a change of tactics that the Trump administration did over what Obama was doing before to try to block the suit?
Well, the first decision of the district court denying the government's motion to dismiss occurred 2 days after Trump's election. So we don't know exactly how the Obama Justice Department would have handled this, but we've been facing what are frankly very aggressive sort of commercial corporate bulldog litigator tactics from the Trump administration ever since. And so it has been, they've tried a number of different means, essentially, again, treating the exceptions to the rule almost like the rule and saying, you know, the court must grant us this early appeal. And they finally succeeded in getting an early appeal. And so that's what we'll be defending tomorrow. The government will be saying that these plaintiffs don't have standing, that this is a political issue that the court shouldn't be wading into, and that, you know, our claims don't have merit. And we will be arguing they do have standing. This is an appropriate matter for judicial consideration, and our claims do have merit. And the Ninth Circuit will decide on that and hopefully send the case back down to the district court for trial.
And so then if the decision goes in the way that you hope, so when would the trial be?
Probably looking at best case scenario, probably 6 months after that.
Kind of a year after
as
it was supposed to be.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we were supposed to go to trial on October 29 last year, and 10 days before the government ran to the Supreme Court and got a temporary stay. So, you know, I don't want to be suggesting that we'll be at trial on a particular date, because you never know. But we're sort of... The government's running out of options to try and keep this case from going to trial.
So they can't pull another interlocutory appeal as they just pulled?
No. There's a few other mechanisms they can use. I mean, the U.S. federal court system is full of all kinds of interesting motions to prevent the ordinary processes of civil litigation proceeding, particularly when the government's a defendant. But we're hopeful that, you know, perhaps we'll have to go to the Supreme Court after this, but we will get our day in court and all the facts will come out.
Well, I have the address now for Director's Park. It's 815 Southwest Park Avenue, and it's actually this like square block park. It's a really nice park on top of a parking structure, mm-hmm. and is right, I think Fox Theater is on one side
Fox
of it.
Theory.
So you'll recognize it. Anyway, and people recommend get down there by walking public transit or bicycling. It's going to be a pretty crowded scene. So the all the promotion of her for this is talking about 1,000 people or more being there. And Amanda, you've been really instrumental in turning out the crowd. So you think you'll be at least 1,000 people?
I think so, yeah. I think there's going to be more than that. Looking at how many people said they're going on Facebook already, like, I'm pretty sure there's going to be like over 1,000 people there.
I just want to throw out, because this is something I've been thinking about in the back of my mind all morning. This is actually the third anniversary of the Mosher oil train explosion. When an oil train derailed in Mosher and almost set the town on fire. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to bring that into our consciousness as we're fighting and supporting this lawsuit, because those coal trains, it's still coal trains going through the gorge, but the oil trains that are going through the gorge pose even a worse threat. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are increasing climate change, but they're also going through a forest that is much more of a tinderbox due to climate change. And that makes me think about all this. I'm not sure how many fires, hundreds of fires in Alberta burning right now. And the smoke is starting to wend its way at least into eastern Oregon. So these are things to think about. And I'm wondering, how do you talk about this in connection with this trial?
I was going to say, I feel like that kind of relates to another thing that I think is happening with the hearing tomorrow is our motion for preliminary injunction.
Yeah,
that's
so that
a thing, right?
Yeah. Preliminary injunction, yes.
Yeah, so because of some of the delays that have occurred in this case, we decided that we needed to move from more of a defensive posture to more of an offensive posture or an attack posture. And so one of the things we need to do in order to preserve the remedy that we want for these plaintiffs at the end of the day is we said, well, we need to ask the court, while it hears this appeal, to enjoin or to prohibit new leasing of coal on federal lands, new oil and gas leasing in the outer continental shelf, and new fossil fuel infrastructure. So,
and
a slightly larger version of the moratorium that Obama issued actually at the end of his administration that's since been rescinded.
Now, legally, how does that work to try to get a preliminary injunction against these things?
So, legally speaking, we need to show that there's a reasonable probability of success on the merits of at least one of our claims. And so we argued that. And we also need to show that that the government won't suffer any harm in the meantime. And we had declarations from experts, including Joe Stiglitz from Columbia University, Nobel Prize winner, who said, you know, the US doesn't need this additional development. And actually, you know, it's just delaying an inevitable transition off of fossil fuels and towards renewable energy. And we need to show that the harms that our plaintiffs will face, that the sort of balance is tips in favor of us rather than in favor of any harm that the government could foreseeably suffer. And you need to put forward evidence in that motion, and the government, to respond to that, needed to put forward evidence. The government didn't put forward any evidence. So it'll be interesting to see how the Ninth Circuit deals with that as well.
And I mean, just briefly, I have some like interesting numbers related to that. That was on our media advisory. But the motion points to 60 new oil and gas pipelines, 32 new liquefied natural gas and coal terminals, and one new deep water port oil export facility awaiting federal approvals, which just for context is kind of insane like to me.
Yeah. Well, one last thing I wanted you to talk about, Vic, was your standing. What is giving you standing in this trial? Because we talked about this before we went on the air, and you mentioned two things that really struck me, Hurricane Sandy and pollen.
Yeah. So in my standing, in my part of the complaint, the things that are addressed are Hurricane Sandy's impact on New York and my ability to go to school. My electricity went out.
You were living in the West Village at that time?
No, at the time I was living with my mom in the Hudson Valley. And also talking about pollen, talking about increased pollen in the air due to climate change and just my inability to like go outside like is a typical thing for every young person in New York to do. And talking about increased heat due to climate change in the summers. New York City is on track to become one, as climate change progresses in the next decades, it could become one of the hottest cities in the world during the summer.
I already thought it was. I used to live there.
Yeah, when you're there in between all the buildings and all the concrete, it feels like you're in the desert. But addressing the fact I'm a first generation American, my family's part of an Afro-Indigenous culture in Honduras, and we live on the northern coast, and we're a critically endangered indigenous culture, and climate change has a lot to do with that. So talking about holding on to culture, and then another part of my standing is the psychological harms of climate change.
I'm wondering if anybody is including sea level rise, which actually would impact New York City quite gravely.
Yeah, plaintiffs in Florida, we have a plaintiff in Rain, Louisiana, who dealt terribly with the flooding that happened 2 years
2016,
ago. 2016,
I think.
In 2016.
Yeah. Of course, there's flooding going on like crazy right now in the Midwest.
Yeah, yeah. That's in Wisconsin. I don't remember if I've added that to my standing or that. But yeah, the impacts in the Midwest are something that I've discussed too. We have plaintiffs in Florida who deal a lot with climate change, or with sea level rise as a part of their impacts and what they talk about.
Well, in the last few moments, I just wanted to see if you want to all go around and just kind of give me your last thoughts. Like, Amanda, you've been organizing for this rally for a few weeks now, months, whatever.
2 months, yeah.
Right. So I just want to know your sense about what you're looking forward to in the rally and after the rally.
Yeah, I think going around to different colleges, it's amazing how many people have heard of the case but haven't really gone too far past that. Mm-hmm. And I think my favorite part of just like going around to like, I was at PSU doing flyering with a group of students from Lewis and Clark, and my favorite part was just like having conversations with people, just like sitting there talking to people about it, and like just I feel like we don't really have a culture that gives us a chance to actually talk about this a whole lot. We kind of see it as like how I used to see it is like, oh, like leave it for the professionals to deal with. But this like affects all of us. So we should all have a say in this. And I think everyone deserves to be in on the conversation.
Well, Amanda, I want to thank you very much for getting me involved. And I appreciate that you were flying at Bill McKibben's presentation, and you got me connected with all these people, so thanks. Danny, what's your hopes after the hearing tomorrow?
I mean, we're quietly confident that the Ninth Circuit will issue a ruling that will allow us to go to trial in the near future. And from that point, you know, I think I just want the broader movement to understand that, you know, this is a case that is looking to get a judicial declaration of rights that the broader movement can use to get the kind of policies and programs put in place to, you know, to reverse the climate crisis. And as frustrating as it's been to have to keep going back to these appellate courts before we've had a trial and to keep fighting against the same arguments over and over and over again, it's also been an opportunity to form connections and build solidarity in the broader movement. And so I hope that will continue going forward as well.
And Vic, your last thoughts?
Yeah, I'm kind of echoing what Amanda was saying, just looking at the accessibility of the lawsuit. I think a lot of times, like, hearing about it on maybe the radio or on seeing it on TV or on the news, it's like, oh, well, these 21 young people are doing this thing. But it's for all young people all over the United States. And I think that looking at how young people are going to engage after this, I always like to just leave off saying, you know, we're not inaccessible people. You know, we don't think of ourselves as like celebrity activists or anything like that. And getting involved in the movement, like I was saying before, you don't need to know every single aspect of climate science. I honestly don't. And it's still something that I find that I'm able to talk about and able to enjoy working on. And yeah, just encouraging other young people to take that leap into getting into the movement, because it can be scary, but it's also so rewarding.
And you can get into the movement by going to the rally tomorrow at Director's Park at 1:30. It's at 815 Southwest Park Avenue here in Portland. It's a support rally for Juliana versus the United States Youth Plaintiffs for our constitutional rights to a stable climate. And the hearing will be going on at the Mark O. Hatfield Courthouse starting at 2 o'clock. I want to thank everybody for joining us today. This has been a wonderful time to connect with this very important event. It's been called the trial of the century, I guess, by some people. Today we've been talking about the Juliana versus U.S. lawsuit, and my guests have been Danny Noonan, a lawyer at our Children's Trust, Vic Barrett, one of the plaintiffs, and Amanda Hendrickson, a Lewis and Clark student organizer. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KVFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll get the Puget Sound perspective on the proposed world's largest methanol refinery in Kalama with Washington Sierra Club organizer Cecile Gernes and Claudia Riedner with Redefined Tacoma. And then I think in a few weeks, we're going to have a happy show about birds. I ran into Bob Salinger yesterday, and he says, why don't let's stop talking about climate change and talk about birds. So,
I love birds.
So my engineer is Patsy Colberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Sweet Honey in the Rock. Thanks for listening.
Your children are not your children. They are the sons and the daughters of life's longing for it.